All right. Well, let's turn into John chapter 9 this morning. Now, as we had just finished up in chapter 8, we were looking at the discourse that Jesus was sharing there in chapter 8. The Feast of Tabernacles had ended, and Jesus was there declaring himself in the temple, saying, "I am the light of the world," there in verse 12 of chapter 8. Now, as we move into chapter 9, we see how this is so wonderfully illustrated in the healing of a blind man, a man who was in darkness, yet who was healed, and how he came to the light of just who this Jesus was. And today, as we go through chapter 9, we are going to look at the various stages of belief that this man goes through as he begins to see more and more clearly this light of the world as Jesus proclaimed himself to be. Let's pick it up in verse 1, chapter 9. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work." So, you remember at the end of chapter 8 there, it said that Jesus had slipped out of the temple. People were rising up to basically stone Jesus for declaring himself to be the I Am, declaring deity upon himself, that he was one with God, that he was God. And so the people were inciting a riot, and Jesus slipped out from them. And so we see now that Jesus is walking freely. There was most likely a period of time that had elapsed here. And as Jesus is walking with his disciples, they see a man. And he was blind from birth. Now, possibly the disciples there had known who this person was. Maybe they had seen him from time to time, because they were well aware that he was a blind man inflicted from his birth. And it's the only time in the Gospels that we hear of a person who is afflicted from his birth. Remember the man who was an invalid, who was by the pool of Bethesda, and that was in chapter 5. It said that he had been that way for 38 years. It didn't say that he was that way from birth. And so this is the only time in the Gospels we hear somebody who is going to be healed, who was healed from an infirmity right from his birth. And so the disciples ask this question, saying, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now, it was a common thought in that day that suffering was the result of sin. In other words, if you had something the matter with you, if you were sick, or if there was a disease, or if there was some kind of handicap that you had, it was a result of sin in your life. There was something that you had done that caused you to be this way now. Suffering resulted from sin. But now, we need to ask another interesting question. How could this man's sin be the result of his blindness if he were born blind? Well, there were a couple popular thoughts that were viewed upon in this day. First of all, there was the belief in prenatal sin. They thought that a child could begin to sin right from the womb. Here's my wife Michelle sitting here, and she's pregnant. And they would say that, well, that baby in that womb right now could be just sinning up a storm. It could be just doing some disastrous things. And they would take the verse in Genesis chapter 25. Why don't you turn with me there? You know, Jacob and Esau, as they were there in the womb together. Let's turn to Genesis 25. And reading in verse 22, it said this: But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Ryan. Sorry, no. Called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So we see the situation there in the womb, just a struggle taking place there. Two nations warring there in the womb. And as Esau comes out, Jacob is trying to grab a hold of his heel, be the first one out. And so they believe in this day that there was possibility of prenatal sin. Secondly, they also believed in the pre-existence of the soul. These souls were created and were there in wait, waiting to basically take residence in a body. And as the souls were waiting for a body to come and reside in, then those souls were capable of sinning. They were either a good soul or they were an evil or a bad soul. And so these souls, the pre-existence of the soul, were either, you were either corrupt or you were not. You were a good soul. And so they had those two popular beliefs, prenatal sin or the pre-existence of the soul. And so they asked, well, who sinned, this man or his parents, is born blind? Well, people thought that struggles that you went through in life could be a result of what your parents did, or something that your parent, your mom or your dad had done in the past. It could have caused affliction or suffering in your life. And in that, they would take the scripture in Exodus chapter 20, verse 5 and 6, and it says this: "You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of your fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, so they would feel there in this day, as the verse is written, that the Lord would come and visit the children, and they would pay the consequences for the sin of their fathers. But now this verse, and we've got to look at it in the right light, because this verse is meant in a way that so many times children follow the example they see from their parents. And they so often continue on in the same kind of sin that their parents lived in. It is not meant that they will be punished for the things that their parents do. Now, I've also heard it said that this verse could be applied in a way that the Father will come, God will come, and visit each generation in a way of bringing them to Him. He will not shut them out. He will not say, "Sorry, there's been too much sin before you." But in a way of saying that, "I will come and visit them and visit their iniquities. I will come and give them that opportunity to come to me and to walk in my ways." But we see that so many times the children decide to walk in the ways that they see lived in their parents. And sometimes there are consequences for the things that parents have done. You can look at fetal alcohol syndrome. The mom being an alcoholic, and the consequences that the baby has, or the mom taking drugs while being pregnant, and that child being born with a dependency upon the drugs, with an addiction. So we see that there are consequences that sometimes the child needs to face because of the sin of the parents. But listen to Jesus' answer here. He said, neither this man nor his parents sinned. Jesus is saying the suffering that this man went through, or the blindness that this man is dealing with, is not anything to do with his sins, nor is it anything to do with his parents' sins. So many times we're looking to place the blame, aren't we? Saying, well, look at the life I've had to live, or look at my parents, look at what they've done. No. We cannot point the finger nor take or pass the blame on to other people. And yet we're so quick to do that. Jesus simply says that it was not because of his sin or his parents' sins. But he says that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. Now, you know in the original manuscripts that there were no punctuations or anything like that. And so verse 3 and 4 could actually be read this way. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, period. But that the works of God should be revealed in him, comma, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. And so, we ask the question, why does suffering happen? Well, suffering, I believe, takes place in the world today primarily because of the overall effect of sin in the world. You look at Genesis chapter 3, let's turn there together. Genesis 3, verse 17. Adam and Eve disobeyed the word of the Lord, the instruction that he had given them. They ate of the fruit of the tree that they were not supposed to. And listen to what God says to them. Remember in verse 16 there, to the woman he said that, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. I believe it was intended for children to be born without pain. It would be no problem. People could, man, without sin in the world, people would just be able to be, ladies could just be walking along and out pop the baby. No problem. No, not having to go to the hospital, not having to have the doctors there, but just boom, out pops the baby. Wouldn't that be great? I'll tell you, I would love that because, you know, just being in the delivery room is hard enough for me. You know, I've got a weak stomach, and that's a pretty tall order for me. I've been in there both with my sons being born, and it was no picnic, let alone for my wife. You know, but wouldn't that be great? Just, oh, yeah, I think baby, oh, yep, there's baby, great. So, oh man, that'd be nice. But then he says to Adam, verse 17, because you've heeded the voice of your wife, men, never listen to your wife. No, I'm kidding you. Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. Till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So we see that the struggle it would be now, just tending the fields and the crops that were to be just so natural. The struggle that comes in and the suffering by the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread. And so we see because of the overall effect of sin in the world, we see the repercussions of that. And we see that suffering does in fact take place. God does allow things to happen. You see, we've got to understand that God is in control of all things. Colossians chapter 1 tells us that all things are held together by Him. And He's got all things in His hand. He's got the world in His hands. But there are times where He just allows things to unravel a bit. We saw that happen in the case of Job. He allowed these things to happen, but so that He might be able to make known His power and His glory. Romans 8:28 says, all things work together for good to those who love God. And we don't need to look any further than the life of Joseph to see that clearly displayed. Here is Joseph. He had everything just going for him, didn't he? Yet he was sold into slavery by his own brothers, taken away from his homeland into Egypt. But there God began to raise him up. God began to do a good work in his life. And though there were times where it could be seen that things were so miserable, being in the prison, but yet all things work together for good to those who love God. And there are times where God allows these things to happen, but for the sake of bringing about His good purpose, to reveal His power and His glory. And Jesus shows us that in verse 3 and 4. But that the works of God should be revealed in Him, I must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. Jesus set out to draw all people to Him. He set out to lead people to Him and to the Father. But there would come a time when He would no longer be with them. He says the night is coming when no one can work. And in the same way, for us guys, we need to press on in our service for God. For we know not when the night is coming. And we should be doing all we can while we have the day to go about and do the work of the Lord. Jesus said in verse 5, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And with Jesus working through our lives, there is still the daylight of ministry. People need to see this light that can bring them out of darkness. While Jesus was here on earth, He said, I am the light of the world. And He said, as long as I'm here, I'm providing that light. I'm giving people an opportunity to come unto Me. There will come a time when He will no longer be there. And guys, you see, Jesus today is desiring to shine through our lives. And we need to take every opportunity that we get to proclaim that light, to let that light shine before men, that they might see our good deeds and glorify our Father in heaven. So, when He had said these things, He spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and He anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And He said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed, and he came back seeing. Now, why did Jesus use such an unusual way of healing this man? He went and spat on the ground, and of that dirt and mud He made this clay that He put on the man's eyes. Well, we know that Jesus did not always do things the same way. And you see, it prevented people from formularizing things into a certain pattern, or prevented them from saying, this is the way it always needs to be done. See, we're quick to do that today, aren't we? To say, well, it needs to be done this way because that's the way it's been done in the past. But you see, we serve a unique and a diverse God. He's not to be bound in a box or say that this is the way that He needs to operate. No. He's unique. He can do things in whatever way He chooses. And we need to be faithful to to follow His leading and the way that He desires to work. You look at this man. He got mud put on his eyes. And he's told, go wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, if I were this man, I think I'd be pretty quick to be saying, Jesus, what are you doing, man? I look like a fool. I got mud on my eyes. Well, he wouldn't know what he looks like because he was blind, but he probably would have felt pretty stupid. And maybe if we were there, we would have been quick to say, I got to get this off. But we see that this man went in obedience. He went in complete obedience and he followed in faith of what the Lord was going to do in his life. Now, Chuck Smith points out that by putting the mud on his eyes could have been also a way of triggering this man's faith. We've seen that, or we talked about that before through chapter 5. And you look at the woman who was suffering from the bleeding. She said, if only I could touch the hem of his garment, I would be made well. And as she reached out in faith, she was healed. You see, putting the mud on his eyes would have begun to kindle that expectation and release that faith in this blind man. And so we see that this man went in faith. He went in obedience. And he went to the pool of Siloam and there washed. It says that he went and washed and came back seeing. Now, why else would Jesus have possibly done it this way? Well, this healing was done when? It was done on the Sabbath. We'll see that later on here. And this is what really got the ball rolling for the Jews in their hatred towards Jesus. He had healed the paralytic man from chapter 5 on the Sabbath. Now you remember what the Jews said there in chapter 5 and in verse 18, where it says, therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father. Not only did he break the Sabbath, that's what really got the ball rolling for them. They were angry over that, upset, and Jesus went and came and healed again on the Sabbath. And he made mud. Now, making mud was one of those things that you just could not do on the Sabbath. They had all their list of things that they could not do. They couldn't work. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't even heal a person on the Sabbath. If there was a person dying, you could not make that person well. All you could do was do what you needed to preserve his life, to keep him from dying. But you couldn't do anything to make him well, because that would be work. So if a person was like bleeding to death, you could just go and stop that wound from bleeding, but you couldn't do anything else to make him well. That's how strict they were on the Sabbath. And making mud, that was work, that was a burden, that was something you couldn't do. And so Jesus goes, he makes mud, he does it on the Sabbath. And so Jesus, I love this about him, he is going and he's challenging their traditions and rules outright by not only healing on the Sabbath, but by using mud in the process. It's kind of like Jesus is just having a bit of fun. He's just kind of pushing their buttons, getting them going, isn't he? So he went, he washed, and he came back seeing. Now, John makes note to translate the word Siloam. He translates it, says it means sent. Now, the story behind the Pool of Siloam. The main water supply for Jerusalem was the spring of Gihon. But you see, it was outside the city walls of Jerusalem. Now, when King Hezekiah was king, he ordered it to be blocked off. He was worried that invading armies could come and they could make use of that water supply, but also they could block it off so that people in the city could not have access to water. So they figured, we've got to do something about that. We've got to close it off and get water into our own city. So what he put out the decree or order to do was to go and dig a tunnel from that spring of Gihon and bring that water underground through the tunnel or aqueduct into the city walls. And you can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20, and also in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. So they had this tunnel made that led the waters into the city from this spring, into this pool of Siloam. And it was called Sent because the waters were sent through this tunnel. What a great picture, isn't it, of Jesus being the living water sent from above to the earth to bring this living water to our thirsty souls. What a great picture that is. So, this man goes, washes, and he comes back seeing. This is the one kind of miracle that was done more than any other by Jesus, the healing of blindness. Yet it's interesting that no prophet or priest or apostle ever gave sight to blind eyes. You see, Jesus showed himself to be clearly the Son of God by what he did. He was the light of the world, and he opened people's eyes and hearts to see this light. Let's pick up in verse 8. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, "Is not this he who sat and begged?" Some said, "This is he." Others said, "He is like him." He said, "No, I'm he. I'm the one. You were right." Now, this man, they said, "Isn't he the one that went, that sat and begged?" Now, if you were afflicted with some kind of handicap or disease or blindness, there was really not much else for you to do other than to sit and beg. That was really going to be your only source of income. You would not be able to work anywhere, make money doing anything else. You would have to go and sit and beg. And possibly that's how the disciples knew this man, because he was there, that they would go and pass by him several times and see him out begging. So he declares to those guys, to the neighbors, "Yeah, I'm he." Now, as he came back, his neighbors noticed something different about this guy. They noticed that there was something different. "Hey, isn't that the guy? What if something different?" And of course, he was able to see. No doubt about it. A big difference there. But you see, in the same way, when people come to Jesus Christ and are saved, there should be an evidence of a change in that person's life. Now, sometimes there's a slow process of that change, but sometimes there's an immediate change. Either way, when a person comes to Christ and they are now able to see, they're no longer blind to the things of Christ, there should be an evidence of a change there. And I think that's very natural. And I think we've all seen that in people when they are saved, when they come to Christ. When you talk to that person or see that person, there's just something different about him. And sure, he's a new creation. Of course, there's something different. Christ is in him. And he's seeing things differently now. Just as this blind man was now seeing things differently. Therefore, they said to him, "How were your eyes opened?" They said, "How were your eyes opened?" The right question is not how, but who. Just switch those letters around from how, turn into who. That's the question we need to ask. We're so concerned with how is that going to happen? How is that going to take place? The Lord sometimes has something in store for us. We think, "How, Lord, can that be?" When all we need to recognize is who is doing it. That's the right question. They say that owls are wise. Wise is an owl. What do owls say? Who? Not how. Maybe that's why they're so wise, because they're asking the right question. And the man answered and said, "A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to the pool of Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and I received sight." Then they said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." Now notice this man's testimony was simple at the beginning. He told what he knew. But each time that he shares, we're going to see that he grows in his knowledge of who Christ is. And he asked him, where is he? He did not know. It's sad that he lost sight of the giver of sight. It's sad when people lose sight of the giver of true life for them. When people come into a relationship with Christ, and men are changed. It's sad to see when people lose sight of Him, and when they lose sight of the giver of life, man, they're going to lose hope in life. We need to keep our eyes upon Him. Verse 13. They brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees. Now it was the Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put clay in my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Therefore some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such things? And there was a division among them. They said to the blind man again, what do you say about him, because he opened your eyes? He said, he is a prophet. You see, now his understanding is beginning to grow. Now a prophet was one commissioned of God and attested by the signs that he did. Moses and Elijah, good examples of that. The signs that they did. Jesus was one that came and demonstrated these signs. And he's beginning to see, well, he's a prophet. What was the first thing he shared in his testimony back in verse 11? He said, a man called Jesus. That's all we knew of him, but now he's beginning to grow a bit. We'll know he's a prophet. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. You see, they were trying to discredit this miracle, weren't they? They're figuring out, well, we've got to make this seem like it didn't really happen. We've got to find some kind of loophole. And so they desire to bring his parents in. Maybe they'll back us up by saying, well, this isn't our son. Or, well, this is our son, but he wasn't born blind. And so they brought the parents in. And the interrogation begins in hopes of undermining what Jesus did. Verse 19, and they asked them, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? And his parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we don't know. Or who opened his eyes, we don't know. They asked the right question, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. He is of age, ask him. He will speak for himself. The parents passed the buck here, in hopes of keeping their good standing. And John tells us why in verse 22. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. That was a serious thing in that culture, to be put out of the synagogue, to be excommunicated. People feared that. They wanted to be careful that they would never have to face that. Because being sent out of the synagogue was not just, you know, okay, you're out for today, we'll see you again next week. No, you were basically a social outcast. Nobody would want to have any kind of dealings with you or associate with you or be near you. You were excommunicated from the temple. That would have made life miserable. It would have been a real struggle. Being a social outcast. And the parents here we see, they feared that. They feared the Jews, it says. They were worried what might come of it. These parents, you see, they were seeking honor from men rather than honor from God. We should strive to be God pleasers and not people pleasers. See what happens when we become people pleasers? We allow people to dictate what we do, instead of following the Lord's will. I pray that today we would all in this room be God pleasers. desiring to carry out His will, no matter what that might mean or no matter what that might result in. We know that the Lord will be with us. Be a God pleaser. Seek to honor and glorify Him. And don't be in fear of man. That there is a dead end road. Therefore his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." Now, give God the glory was a way of making an oath. We see that in Joshua chapter 7, verse 19, where Joshua was talking to Achan and dealing with the sin there in the camp. He said, "Achan, give God the glory. Speak the truth here." Now, it could also be the Jews saying, "Listen, don't take the credit from God. Give God the glory. Don't give it to Jesus. He's not worthy of that." I'm trying to take the credit from Jesus to God only. They say, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." And this man answered and said in verse 25, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. I was blind, now I see." This here, guys, is the evidence that cannot be argued. Changed lives today is the greatest proof of Christianity. When you see a person that was just messed up coming to Christ and seeing a changed life, that's the evidence of Christianity that can't be argued. This man just simply says, "Listen, I'm tired of all this. This I can say, I was blind, but now I see." Could you imagine this guy? He, blind all his life, finally is able to see. But yet also he's thrust into the synagogue with these angry people. These people trying to discredit this miracle. What a shame that is. This poor man. Wouldn't you have just loved to have sat back and soak in all the glory and the beauty around you? Instead, he's seen and being faced with these Jews, these Pharisees, that are trying to make this something that really wasn't. Or trying to make nothing of this. Then they said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And he answered them, "I told you already, and you do not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" Now this man, as I said, was just getting tired of all this. And now he's kind of having a little bit of fun with these guys. "Oh, I get it. You're wanting to become his disciples too. Oh, I see now." Oh, that would have just been, you know, ticking these guys right off, wouldn't it? They were just getting furious over this. And it says in verse 28, "Then they reviled him and said, 'You are his disciples, but we are Moses' disciples.'" Now you remember back as we were studying through chapter 8. Now the Jews there were saying, "We're children of Abraham. Abraham is our father." But Jesus said, "Well, if Abraham were truly your father, you would do the works of Abraham." What was the works of Abraham? Well, he believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. He believed that through him the seed would come, the Messiah would come and bring life. And it was credited to him as righteousness. And yet Jesus said, "If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. You would believe in me." And in the same way, saying, "We're Moses' disciples." Well, if they were Moses' disciples, truly, well, would they not do the works of Moses? Look in chapter 5 of John. And let's look at verse 45. "Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." says, if you believe Moses, if you were truly his disciples, well, then you would believe me. For he wrote about me. What did Moses write? Well, he wrote in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren, him you shall hear. Speaking of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And again in Deuteronomy 18, verse 18, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. If they were truly Moses' disciples, well, they would have been in a better state than what they are, but they had a deaf ear and a blind eye to the things of Christ. And they said in verse 29, we know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from. The man answered and said to them, why, this is a marvelous thing that you don't know where he is from, yet he's opened my eyes. You see, their denial of Jesus healing this man, in spite of all the evidence, was basically more amazing than the actual healing itself. That they could see everything, that this man was born blind, that he was begging throughout his life, that now he was able to see, his parents testifying of that. Yet the fact that they were trying to disprove that, or not believing this, was a marvelous thing to this man. That in itself is more of a miracle than the healing itself. He said, you don't know where he's from, yet he's opened my eyes. That, he's saying, guys, should be proof enough. He's healed me. That should be pretty clear who he is and where he's from. That he's of God. Now we know that God does not hear sinners. But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Now they base that fact, God does not hear sinners, from a few different verses. And a couple verses they applied to that saying was this. Psalm 66:18, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear. And in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 15, when you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Since the world began, verse 32, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. You see, this miracle, it was never seen in the Old Testament. And then this man goes on to say, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So this man, who was just given a sight, is now basically preaching there to the Jews. He's just laying it on the line for them. And this man's testimony was right on. But you see, the religious leaders became prideful. They were prideful. And they became irrational. And they turned to ridicule because they had no answer to this man. They said in verse 34, they answered and said to him, you were completely born in sins. And are you teaching us? And they cast him out. Oftentimes when a person does not have an answer or does not have anything left to argue, there's no argument to make, they turn to ridicule. We saw that there in chapter 8, in verse 48. And the Jews answered and said to him, do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Jesus was talking to him, and they had nothing to counter with, and so they say, you're a Samaritan, you have a demon. They turn to ridicule and mocking, and they do it this man now. You were completely born in sins. This man was giving just a right-on message for these guys. But they were too prideful to hear it. Too prideful to listen. You know, it's unfortunate that even today people's pride keeps them from learning and growing in the Word. I pray that we will always be at a place where we can be taught, where we can be teachable. That's where we need to be. There are those that feel, well, you know, I've read through the Word a few times and I basically know it all. You know, don't try to tell me anything because I've got it all under wraps. I've got it all under control. Man, that's a sad place to be. We always should be at that place where we can be taught, where we can be teachable. We need to continually be pressing on in the things of the Lord. So Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" What a wonderful picture this is. This man is cast out of the synagogue now. Yet what happened? Jesus came and found him. And he is now accompanying him. You know, through life we may encounter rejection. We may encounter separation from people. But you know, the Lord will be with us. He's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. And though we go through trials, though we go through difficulties, it brings us to a closer walk with the Lord. This man has just been going through one big trial there with the Jews. But what happened? It brought him to a closer walk with Jesus. What a great picture that is. Oh, I love that. And Jesus said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And he answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. When this man realized that Jesus was the Son of God, what happened? He was filled with the reverence and awe and a desire to worship him. And I pray that we will come into contact with Jesus daily. That we will see clearly who he is. This man saw clearly, "You are the Son of God." And I pray that we can be people that grow in our knowledge of Christ and are in contact with Him daily. What will be the result of that? Oh, we'll desire to worship Him. We will be worshipers. Man, we're going to be filled with just awe and reverence and love for Him that compels us just to come and worship Him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I've come into the world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." Now some people might look at that and think, well, that's a contradiction to what Jesus said back in chapter 3. He said in chapter 3, verse 17, he said, "For God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be saved." And here he's saying, "For judgment I've come into the world." Some people will look at that and think, well, that's a contradiction there in the Word. But what he is simply saying is that there are those who will be judged because they have rejected. They have rejected the light of the world. You see, the reason that Christ came was for salvation. But the result was judgment because people did not accept the salvation that Jesus came to offer. The reason he came was for salvation, but the result of that, when people rejected and turned their backs on him, was judgment. Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see.' Therefore, your sin remains." Now, what Jesus is saying here in these last two verses is that if the Pharisees had recognized that they were blind and that they were in need of spiritual sight, well, they could have been healed and set free. You see, it's only when we come to Jesus and recognize that we are in need that he can do a work. But since these guys, the Pharisees, felt that everything was A-okay, they thought, we're fine. We can see clearly. We're okay. Jesus says that they remain in their sin. You see, there was a spiritual pride and a confidence in their own abilities and knowledge. They felt that they had it all together, but they were actually lost and they were walking in darkness. And thus, Jesus says, since you say that we see, we're okay, we're in the light. Well, he says, your sin remains because you were walking in darkness. Jesus came, said, I am the light of the world. And he came and restored sight to this man. He allowed this man to see the light in the world. This man was able now to see the light in the world. But as we go through this chapter, what do we see? We see how this man grew in his belief in the Lord, and how he not only began to see the light in the world, but how he clearly began to see the light of the world. The three stages of knowledge that this man came to of who Jesus was. Remember, first of all, he said he was a man in verse 11. Then in verse 17, he said that he was a prophet. And then in verse 38, he realized he is the Son of God. Guys, the more that we know Jesus, the more that we spend time with him, the greater he will become to us. May we be continually growing in our faith, growing in our knowledge of Jesus, and may it be bringing us to a deeper faith in him, that we can know and see this light of the world more and more clearly. Let's pray.